Let's go exploring in some of the most unruly places on Earth. With the rise of the internet and globalization, we may think the world's been completely explored, no stone left unturned.
But our next guest says the world is still pretty mysterious, and he is here to share some of the most secret places on Earth with us. He is Alistair Bonnett, a professor of social geography at Newcastle University, and the author of the book we'll be talking about, Unruly Places, Lost Spaces, Secret Cities, and Other Inscrutable Geographies. Alistair, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, it's good to be here.
Well, it is good to have you along. I want to start out talking about your definition of unruly places and this idea of geographical imagination. When I first picked up the book, the sort of the dead cities, the secret cities, I got that. But there's so much more. There are traffic circles, there are fox dens, there are labyrinths. How do you define, I guess, an unruly place? What makes it unruly?
Well, I'm looking at places that challenge our expectations of place, that make us rethink what we know about place, and what our relationship is to this very fundamental factor in all our lives. So, unruly places for me are places that take the idea of place and twist it and make us reconnect with place and its strangeness, its enchantment.
And before we start exploring those particular places, why is place and our connection to place so important to us as humans?
Yeah, I know. Well, this is a great question, and I wish it was asked more, because I think our connection to place has started to wither in the modern world when places become so similar. You get globalization and a homogenization, those sorts of forces, and they start to make a lot of us worry that the places that we know, that we care about, are no longer distinctive. And it's in that atmosphere, in that climate, that we have to start asking again, what is it about our relationship to place? Why does place matter so much? And it is, I think, that we are a place-making, place-loving species. I think it defines us as a species. We're place-making, we're place-loving. That's what we do.
So, given that, placemaking, place-loving, when you're setting out to write a book like this, where do you start? Where do you begin? It seems like there's lots of places to look, but not every place might not give you the thing you're looking for.
Well, I wanted to find places that surprised me. That's how I approached the book. I wanted to go out and see if I can locate, research, or visit, in some cases, places that I hadn't even heard of, that were really jaw-droppers. Not the kind of usual list of, hidden secret government military bases and the kind of things that we're familiar with, but places that were really off the map and new, because it's those sorts of places that I thought could help me and help readers reconnect and rethink about our relationship to place and the world.
Well, speaking of off the map, you start with a place that is more or less literally off the map, Sandy Island.
Yeah, that's right. This is one of the ones that really got me going. And Sandy Island, which was on the map for a long time, was 15 miles long, not entirely tiny in the Pacific. Kind of west of New Caledonia, a pretty obscure sort of place, not a place that gets a lot of traffic, but it'd been on the map since 1876, and it was on the Times Atlas of the World, it was on Google Earth. It was only in 2012 when some Australian scientists, decided to go and visit Sandy Island, that they found out that it didn't exist, that it wasn't there, that no such place had ever existed. Google Earth had to stitch over that spot with some sea. And what I like about this story is that, well, partly because it shows us that maps aren't completely reliable even today in 2014, but also that the Google Earth users then started uploading all these crazy photographs onto Sandy Island, So now if you visit this spot, you'll find photographs of fantastic temples and dinosaurs and the back streets of Detroit and all sorts of stuff. So it's become a real kind of, I don't know, escape zone for geo-geeks.
So why does this island matter, this idea that it was there and then it's not, and
yeah,
it's still not, so who cares?
Yeah, who cares? Well, indeed, partly you might say who cares, because a lot of islands used to be on the map and aren't anymore, and this is one of the last remaining residues of a process that's been going on for 100 years of deleting mistakes from the world map. But why it seems to matter is that in a world that is so fully known, that is so fully visible, down to like 50 centimeters or whatever it is the resolution is on modern satellites, a world that is so fully known, what we need, I think, is places to escape to, places which aren't on the map, places which aren't fully visible. There's something about undiscovered, unexplored, and hidden places, which is fundamentally fascinating, I think, to people.
We're talking to social geographer Alistair Bonnett about his new book, Unruly Places.
And you could join the conversation. Do you have a favorite secret, isolated spot, maybe in your own community, maybe in your backyard? What are the most unruly, unusual places you've traveled to? And do you agree with our guest that we need to capture our connection to place, recapture it? Put the magic back in to places around the world. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post, maybe with a picture, on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're picking up our discussion with social geographer Alistair Bonnett about his new book on uncharted territory. It's called Unruly Places.
And Alistair, let's visit another unruly place, a desert that used to be a sea. The Aralkum Desert?
Oh, yeah. Well, it used to be the Aral Sea. Aralkum Desert is a bit of a new term. I mean, it's one I had to come up with myself, because the Aral Sea is no longer a sea. It's pretty much mostly a desert. And the Kum on the Aral Kum just refers to desert. The Kum is the Uzbek for desert. What we have now is somewhere that is still on a lot of maps, a lot of globes, and a lot of classrooms around the world, but is now a kind of dried out and very dusty desert.
And you know, when you look at that, when you see photographs of that place, and you know, the idea of a large ship being, you know, 10 miles away from water, and villages where ports used to be, and they're gone now, and all the stuff there, it reminds you that when you're looking at a place, you have certain expectations. And seeing a ship, an ocean-going ship sort of lying on its side in the desert, throws everything out of context. How does that affect that whole sense of place you're talking about?
Yeah, it's eerie, isn't it? I think a lot of us are living with places that are abandoned or have changed rapidly. The Aralkum Desert is just a very spectacular example of one of the world's largest lakes that now virtually no longer exists. But many of us can just look around the corner to look at our home streets or shopping outlets, which used to be a certain way, and you know, over the past couple of years have changed rapidly. So we live in a world where the geography around us is changing at a faster and faster pace, and that is disorientating. It makes us wonder what our connection is to place, and it throws a lot of doubts. In my mind, at least, about you know what it is I'm connected to, what my identity really is.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Jeanette on the line in McGregor, Illinois. Jeanette, hi.
Hi there. I would like to nominate any of the underground, lots of caves. I'm a member of the Iowa Grotto of the National Spelunking Society, and just this weekend we were in some sinkholes, as well as some other horizontal and vertical caves. So those are largely unknown, whole other world to themselves. Lots of animals that are only underground. And that's something that most people never see.
Jeanette, thank you. I think that fits really well. And Alistair, it also reminds me of an underground location in your book, The Labyrinth, one of the closer locations to us here in Wisconsin.
Yeah, this is somewhere under the Twin Cities, St. Paul, Minneapolis. It was called The Labyrinth by the urban explorers who've been down there, because what you've got is miles, tens of miles of subterranean passageways, of caves, sometimes formed from the utility companies, sometimes the warehouses of companies that were digging out space underneath the city. There's a real hidden adventure waiting for explorers under many of our cities, and it's one of the new zones of exploration. For years, explorers, you know, went thousands of miles across the world and to chart new territory. Well, today, increasingly, just looking around the corner or going under the city streets.
Another time you spent some time underground in a very different sort of way, when you spent some time looking for a fox's den. And talk about that a little bit, because it's underground. It's not someplace people would necessarily go to, and yet it's a place.
It is a place. Well, because I was thinking about human places so much in this book, and then it just struck me, I'm missing something here. I'm missing the fact that we share our spaces with other species. And like the caller was saying, there's a lot of interesting animals and other species out there who also have their routines and their routes to work, as it were, and have their homes and their own places. And I was looking at this fox that was sitting at the back end of my garden, and I tried to follow it. I lost it pretty quick, I have to say, but I knew it went into to the local park, and I tried to track down its den. And eventually, I think I found its rather kind of scrubby little den in my local park. But it was such a, you know, prosaic, ordinary thing to do, tracing an animal and its pathways. But once you start doing that in a city, it really opens up the landscape around you. It makes you realize that these city streets are walked by other animals, and that we share our towns.
Well, that makes me think you went all over the world to check out these locations, but part of the concept here is traveling in a different way. But is there also just a mindset change that we can take with us, you know, on the walk to work?
That is it. I really think that is fundamental. I don't think modern explorers are about going thousands of miles or getting expensive plane tickets somewhere exotic. A lot of that kind of travel is a little bit cliched, dare I say it. The kind of really interesting stuff is often around the corner, and revitalizing our geographical imagination means that thinking about the places that we pass by on the way to work every day, maybe just stopping and pausing and getting out of the car even and having a little bit of a poke around, or seeing the city at a different time of day. These are all ways that we can see a new side to our own environments and start to explore the world around us.
You know, as I read your book, I was reminded sort of the impermanence of things, you know, cities rising and falling, fox dens that are there one year and then not the next, traffic circles which rise and then eventually disappear. You know, as you worked your way through all of these places, you're encouraging people to get out there and explore a little bit. Is that why it's important? Because if we don't notice it, we'll never see it?
Yeah, that's right. I am encouraging people to get out there and explore a little, but I'm also encouraging people to realize that these places and the places around us really do matter, and we can't just continue to allow our landscapes, our cities and our towns to become more and more homogenized and more similar. I'm trying to make an argument here for real places, I suppose, for distinctive places, and for hanging on to that sense of distinctiveness, because I think it's so important. And I know there's a lot of crazy, remarkable places in my book, but each of them I use to talk about why place really matters to us.
Alistair, thank you so much for joining us today, and I hope you'll come back and talk some more about these places with us again sometime.
Okay, that'd be great. Thanks.
That was Alistair Bonnett. He's professor of social geography at Newcastle University, the author of Unruly Places, Lost Spaces, Secret Cities, and Other Inscrutable Geographies. So in our mission statement, Gene, is the line for the show, mm-hmm. for Central Time, the line, "Let's go exploring," from Calvin and Hobbes comics.
Sure.
And that's, reading this book, I just kept thinking of that magical sense of place that you see in that comic strip.
Well, we've gone some exploring today, and we're going to do some more in the future, too. It was a terrific book and a terrific reading.
Yeah, a lot of fun.
Lots of things that I had no idea about. It's Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we visit a Star Wars planet for some lessons on real-world science.
First, we're looking at a growing trend here in Wisconsin. High-profile laws are increasingly being decided in the courts instead of legislative chambers.
Legal challenges are nothing new in politics, but analysts have noticed more controversial laws are being decided in the courts as we see more division in politics. And last week's announcement of three big Wisconsin Supreme Court decisions highlighted the issue even more.
Jason Stein is with us now. He is a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and the author with Patrick Marley of More Than They Bargained For, Scott Walker, Unions and the Fight for Wisconsin. Jason, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Gene. Good to be here.
Well, you know, as we mentioned in the introduction, legal challenges are really nothing new in the world of politics and the world of laws. So what is new here that has sort of raised this issue to this level where we're talking about it on the air?
We're talking about, I think, a degree of difference as opposed to, a difference in kind. But, you know, what we have seen is more and more challenges being made. Also, I think, being very made in a very way that tends to be divisive and, controversial. We've certainly saw that in those three decisions last week. You had the Act 10 decision where on upholding Governor Scott Walker's union legislation, you had a decision on domestic partner benefits that mirrors in some ways some of the gay marriage litigation happening at the national level. And then, you've also, in addition to the voter ID cases that were decided by the state Supreme Court, you've also seen a number of lawsuits at the federal level recently in terms of Obamacare or, the Affordable Care Act, as it's more formally known.
So why do you suppose we are seeing such an increase in some of these legal challenges? Is it because the laws themselves are skirting closer to some of these constitutional questions, or is it becoming part of the political process?
You know, I think it's always, I think the courts have always been part of the political process in that you've always had the option, if you couldn't get what you wanted in the state house, to try and get it in the courthouse. But given that, things can often go in that order where a group will try to get the laws written by elected officials to its liking or, maybe try and get them interpreted to its liking. I think it is as the legislative process gets more and more rancorous and more and more partisan, and it gets more and more difficult to find a compromise, let alone consensus in the legislative process. Observers told me that they are seeing, more recourse to the court system to try and settle disputes that aren't necessarily getting settled in legislative bodies.
And at some point, though, it has to be worth it to them, because this type of approach, this type of litigation, is not cheap. I mean, it costs money to get lawyers.
Not. It absolutely costs money for, you know, the plaintiffs, for groups that end up suing the state or federal government, and it costs money for state and federal taxpayers as well, because, you know, litigating one of these cases from trial court all the way to the state or federal Supreme Court can easily cost many hundreds of thousands, even into the millions of dollars. So, you know, it really is something that it's got to be driven by a great passion and great, you know, sort of financial impact to make it feasible for plaintiffs to be willing to bring these cases.
So is this something that's happening just in Wisconsin? I know that on the national level, you know, we see the challenges to Obamacare. We've got the House of Representatives wanting to sue the president and so forth. So it seems as though it's more than just Wisconsin. Is that the impression that you've been getting too?
Sure. I mean, you know, I think, again, Wisconsin is a state that is closely divided between Republicans and Democrats, and it's a state that pretty closely mirrors the overall partisan makeup of the United States as a whole. So it wouldn't be surprising to see this trend be very pronounced here, but you certainly see it at the federal level as well, with, you know, lawsuits of the Affordable Care Act happening in a number of different federal courts. You know, it had been brought in a number of different federal courts, trial level courts around the country. You also see U.S. Senator Ron Johnson, a Republican from Oshkosh, brought a lawsuit having to do with how the Affordable Care Act affects benefits for members of Congress and their staffs. You know, that decision once again was brought in a federal court in Wisconsin, but it certainly has a national character to it. So, right. I mean, it's certainly something, a trend that's happening here, but by no means exclusively here.
So in terms of the people you talk to, are you finding people on either side of this issue who are for more litigation, or does everybody say, no, this is not the way it ought to go, and we're all against it, and we just have to do it to get the process through?
Right. I think, you know, I don't think anyone would use probably the terms of "I am for litigation," but what you do hear is you hear groups, you know, again, the way you typically get a law challenged and struck down is you make a case that it's infringing on your constitutional rights. So what you do see is groups on both sides saying, you know, we're very angry about this controversial piece of legislation. You know, we believe that it has deprived us of the rights that the framers of our Constitution meant us to have, and you know, we see that as a good thing, that we're standing up for our rights. So, you know, you absolutely have that. You have people on the other side saying, look, we used to be able to settle many of these disputes, you know, in committee hearings, in, you know, backroom talks between affected parties in the legislature and so on. And it's really unfortunate that the courts are now being called on to solve these problems, because ultimately they're not going to be able to do so to everyone's satisfaction in a lot of cases, too.
Of the people you talk to, does anybody give you the sense that this is a fundamental change in the democratic process, or is this just sort of an aberration, and 10 years from now, we're not going to have lawsuits like this anymore?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, it's certainly a shift. I mean, I think we could argue about how fundamental it is. I mean, certainly in this state, you saw cases in the 1990s where, you know, lawsuits were brought. You know, you had, for instance, a number of lawsuits brought against Wisconsin Governor Tommy Thompson. Unions, for instance, sued over his private school voucher program that provided taxpayer money to secular and religious private schools. So, I mean, you've certainly seen it before. I mean, I think the question will be, in terms of the trend, is what happens with the resolution of disputes in politics if we continue to have a more and more polarized electorate, a more and more polarized people representing them, it's hard to see the trend going away, right? Because people are going to continue, you know, the losing side is going to continue to be very unhappy about the policies that come out of the legislative bodies, and they're going to look for any way they can, frivolous or not, to try and hold them up in the judicial branch.
Any sense of what constituents think about this, that they might be getting, you know, lawsuit fatigue or something like that?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. I mean, again, if a law is passed, it's passed because a majority of representatives in the legislative body voted for it, and they were in turn put in by voters. So a lot of people would say that they'd like the majority to be able to do what they were elected to do, to govern. You know, the other side of it is we live in a closely divided state and a closely divided country, and the political parties are getting farther apart in terms of what they feel like ought to be done in Wisconsin and in the rest of the country. So what you have is this situation where the winners are seeking more and more of what they want to see in their area, and the losers are seeing more and more of what they don't want to see, you know, that the gaps are widening between them. And I think, you know, as long as that trend continues, you're going to see this trend of lawsuits continue too.
Well, Jason, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Gene. I appreciate it.
We've been talking with Jason Stein, a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and the author, with Patrick Marley, of More Than They Bargained For, Scott Walker, Unions, and the Fight for Wisconsin.
A longish time ago, in a studio far, far away, the planet Tatooine was invented by George Lucas and his team for the Star Wars series of movies.
The desert world was the home of Luke Skywalker, the base of Jabba the Hutt, and now it's taking on a new role, that of a science lesson.
Scientists and science writers are taking part in an online Tatooine Science Carnival, applying the lessons of biology, climatology, and more to the fictional planet. Matt Shipman was with us now. He's a science writer and a public information officer at North Carolina State University. Matt, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So why, Matt, are real-world scientists and science writers doing papers on a made-up planet?
Well, it started with a question that I asked myself as a geek, thinking about Star Wars. If Tatooine is a desert planet, why are all the animals that we see from Tatooine enormous, right? So I took my question to Twitter, which is where one takes unanswerable questions, I guess. And the response was great. There were a lot of science and science fiction fans out there who all had their own takes on it. And I thought, wow, this is something we could tap into to get people excited about science.
Well, here's a clip of one of the author's quotes from a Tatooine native, Luke Skywalker. Mm-hmm. Let's give a quick listen.
Well, if there's a bright center of the universe, you're on the planet that it's farthest from.
So it's the farthest from the bright center of the universe. But when you put the word out, a lot of scientists were excited about this.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that, if you look at today's Google Doodle about the Venn diagram, I think if you did a Venn diagram of scientists and science fiction fans, there would be an enormous amount of overlap. And so getting people, encouraging people to talk about what they know best, science, while talking about something that they really love, Star Wars, it engendered a great deal of enthusiasm.
Before we get into what the scientists wrote about, is this just an exercise of smarter than thou, making fun of this goofy movie for what it gets wrong when it comes to science?
Absolutely not. Everybody who did this, we're all Star Wars fans, and we're not doing this to puncture the extensive mythology that George Lucas has created and that other creative types have built on. Instead, we're simply doing something where we thought it would be a lot of fun. We thought it was something that would get people's attention, and we're I think if we're doing anything, we're sort of celebrating Star Wars. Rather than denigrating Star Wars or trying to nitpick Star Wars.
Well, I know some of the people who took up this challenge were interested in the same question you mentioned earlier. Why does this desert planet have creatures that are so big? What is some of the science that they applied to it, either to explain that or to explain why it probably wouldn't work that way?
Well, that's really interesting. So I'm glad you asked that question. So really, two of the people who wrote, and there were seven people in addition to myself who wrote, tackled that very question. And one of them, by Maggie Korth, who is the science editor at Boing Boing, she talked about why it would be unlikely. So if there was any post that was kind of naysaying, that would be the one. But it's a very thoughtful post about the ecological drivers that are in play and why it would be really difficult for incredibly large animals to evolve to thrive in the desert.
So the idea is that deserts don't have much plant life, so no big herbivores to eat that and nothing to feed the big predators, right?
Right. So if you look at, when I was a kid, it was the food chain. Now we call it the food web, right? But where would all of the energy come from? The plant life that would feed herbivores, which would then feed larger predators and so on. So how would that happen? So she talks about that. But the one that I really loved, and I liked Maggie's as well, but the one that I really loved was by a shark biologist based out of the University of Miami named David Schiffman. And sharks are apex predators, right? They're at the top of the food chain. So he spends a lot of time thinking about that. And he wrote this post explaining that one reason that you would see these enormous animals in a desert environment is that it was not always a desert environment. So you would see banthas, which are the big, shaggy herbivores that the sand people ride on in the movies. So these existed before it was a desert planet when there was lots of plant life for them to eat. But their numbers were kept in check by an apex predator species, which were called crate dragons. And they're referenced in the movies, and you actually see a crate dragon skeleton in the very first movie. Episode 4, first chronologically, but you never see them in motion. And so the theory that David put forward was that when Tatooine was colonized, the settlers killed off most or all of the crate dragons, and with those apex predators taken out of the equation, the population of banthas, the large herbivores, plant eaters, just grew out of control, and essentially they consumed so much vegetation that sort of sped up this desertification process, and it turned a lush green planet into a barren sandy one.
So this is a science fiction example. I imagine there are real world analogs. This came from a shark researcher, for example. Have we seen similar stories with shark populations around the world?
I can't speak to shark populations per se, but, for example, when predator species, my understanding is that when predator species are removed, so, for example, when wolves or mountain lions and so forth in the American West, those population numbers were driven down, you saw a huge increase in the population of deer and elk and other herbivores because there's nothing keeping them in check. And I know, for example, on the East Coast, there's been an explosion of the deer population over the years because they don't really have any natural predators anymore other than humans.
And then another paper in the series, or at least one, gets into, I think it's the Intergalactic Council on Climate Change. What can we learn about climate change from looking at the story of Tatooine?
That's a really interesting one. So David Ng, who wrote it, is actually a molecular biologist. He's based out of the University of British Columbia, but he is maybe the biggest Star Wars fan I've ever met. And so what he was trying to do here, more than anything, I think, was essentially just to get people interested on the real Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which has written extensively and issues reports periodically about the status of global climate change on planet Earth, and to get people who wouldn't normally be interested in that report to pay attention. He created the Tatooine Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And so what he pulled together is really sort of a comprehensive and kind of elaborate teaching prop to get people to pay attention, including some pretty spectacular graphics. But what it is it essentially uses Tatooine as a fictional proxy to walk people through the issues that are related to climate change, such as when the climate change impacts will have an impact on life.
Briefly, Matt, before we're done, what's the response been like from the public and your colleagues on this?
The response has been overwhelmingly positive. When I first told some of my colleagues that we were planning to do this, there were some chuckles, but more than anything, they thought that it was really neat as well. I was actually expecting more skepticism than I got, and this was something which garnered and really I was surprised at the amount of attention that it got. It ended up being featured in The Guardian out of London, in Wired, and even the National Science Foundation put it on their daily news site, Science 360, which was a pleasant surprise to see.
All right, Matt, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right, thanks for having me.
That was Matt Shipman talking about the Tatooine Science Carnival.